Space cowboy. Yeah. And you just have some kind of mushroom, and your mind is moving on. How does the brain connect with the body? How does it wake from a dream?
Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men are mingled with humor. We are the core.
So we're here tonight with Space Cowboy.
Some people call me the Space Cowboy.
Not his real name.
Great, I got Steve Miller Band in my head now.
And basically what we're going to hear is a story of someone who was a very faithful, believing, spiritual Mormon who gave it all up, lost it all, right? And then as a jaded, hate-filled, no moral compass atheist, accidentally stumbled back into spirituality through a field of poppies or something like that, right? Is that a good...
It's like Darth Vader.
The only thing I would change about that is it wasn't a field of poppies. It was a field of mushrooms.
Okay.
Right. Poppies are opiates, man.
Well, I was just trying to Wizard of Oz it.
It was poetic. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, poetic license.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
So, Space Cowboy, let's hear your story.
Oh, sheesh. How much of it do you want? I mean, you don't want, like, the whole... like falling away from the church and all that.
But how important was the church to you? And like I really want to understand when you talk about spirituality.
Right.
What do you mean? So like what was spirituality before? What spirituality after? You know. So kind of set the stage. And you got your own sense for you know how you want this to go. So.
Right. No. That I mean spirituality. The whole idea of it has of course changed for me now. When I was LDS, I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10 of TBMness, I was a 10 out of 10. And I had what I considered a rock-solid, indestructible spiritual foundation for my testimony, consisting of several profound spiritual experiences that I thought were undeniable. And the way I viewed spirituality was in the typical TBM terms, that we all have a spirit body inside of us, that there's this thing called the Holy Spirit, that there are also, you know, spirits around us, both good and evil spirits. So I believed in, you know, my metaphysical beliefs about the nature of reality included things like spirits. And so for me, spirituality was whenever a divine spirit, whether it be, you know, the Holy Spirit, that basically what spirituality was to me was a communion or a connection between the Holy Spirit and my immortal spirit inside my body. That was my understanding of spirituality as a Mormon. Since then, I've come to develop a different, as a result of these experiences that we're going to be talking about with psilocybin mushrooms, and also LSD. I don't know if you want to get into the LSD too, or just the psilocybin mushrooms, but it awakened and reignited something deep inside me that was similar to what I experienced as a Mormon in terms of being a spiritual experience, but different, because I just no longer hold those metaphysical beliefs about spirit bodies. And where I've kind of landed with it is, after I had this experience, this first experience with psilocybin mushrooms, I finally audiobooked William James's Varieties of Religious Experience. Even though I'd been, you know, for a few years not interested in anything religious related, all of a sudden I got interested in, you know, trying to discover a way to be spiritual but not religious. And somewhere floating in the blogosphere, that book got in my head, and I audiobooked it. And it was helpful, because what William James explains is, you know, there's the idea of spirituality referring to some sort of homunculus inside us, some sort of, you know, invisible Casper the Ghost body that's like inside us. That's just one like super literal old way of looking at spirituality. Another way of looking at spirituality that's equally valid is, you know, the word spirit, or the term, the word spirit is used to say, like, for example, someone was in good spirits. Like, it can refer to your mood. Or, that kid has a fighting spirit. It's like, it's something dogged about his character, some sort of essential character attribute. Or you can say, you know, at the negotiations there was a spirit of goodwill. To kind of, you know, the negotiators came with a spirit of goodwill, meaning their intentions. And what I'm getting at is that, you know, your thoughts and your feelings, your interior world, that's what I think of as my spirit or spirituality. And so spirituality to me is anything, basically anything pertaining to my interior world. You know, is it dark or is it light? Is it full of joy and love and compassion and good things? Or is it full of negativity and hate and anger and things like that? That's what spirituality is to me now.
All right, I want to back up just for a minute and kind of ask this question to everybody that's on the call here, but starting with you, Space Cowboy.
Some people call me the Space Cowboy.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to say that without laughing. So if you were to describe your most spiritual experience as a believing Mormon, what would that be?
It would have been when I was just maybe a couple weeks, maybe even only 1 week from leaving on my mission. And the totality of it all just like finally sunk in and hit me like a ton of bricks. I had a girlfriend at the time, that I loved, and I didn't want to leave her. And, you know, I was in school. I was going to be leaving family. You guys know what I'm talking about. I mean, it's a big deal. And there was this moment where I was just like, gosh, you know, I think it's true. I believe it's true. But, man, like a sacrifice this big, I better be sure that it's true. And I better start at square one. I better start at square one and just make sure that I'm sure that God even actually really exists. Because I've always believed in it, and because I've always been taught to believe in him. But, I mean, how do I know that God really exists? And I, you know, went in my bedroom and got down on my knees, and I, you know, prayed the most fervent, sincere prayer that I can remember praying until that point in my life, and just ask, you know, God, are you really there? Are you really there? I need to know this. I'm going to be leaving my family, leaving school, leaving my girlfriend to teach people about you. before I do that, I gotta know, are you really there? And I was, at that moment, overpowered with an incredibly intense feeling of love that just swept through me from head to toe and deep rocked me deep down into the core of my being. And I, you know, I shed tears like right then and there. And I just, that's the type of experience I'm talking about that my testimony is based on. Yeah, there's emotions like, you know, like you hear like, you know, ex-Mormons say, oh, you can feel a spirit watching Lord of the Rings. But to me as a TBM, and I actually still believe this, that's not an apples to apples comparison. Like, yeah, we all know that you can feel, you know, swooning emotions during Lord of the Rings or Star Wars or whatever. But for me anyway, the quote-unquote emotional experiences or the quote-unquote feelings were very distinguishable in terms of their level of profundity. And what I'm talking about is something that transforms you in some significant, lasting way. You know, watching Lord of the Rings, you can feel something, but it's not going to result in some, like, profound, long-lasting inner transformation of your character. The type of spiritual experiences I'm talking about that I experienced as a Mormon, they're the type of transformative, you know, long-lasting sorts of experiences.
But you'd say that maybe there's like a spectrum of spiritual intensity, right? And
absolutely,
you know, so like the Lord of the Rings or listening to really good music and feeling that kind of euphoria
right.
might be kind of midway on the spectrum. Whereas what I'm asking is like, what was the most intense, the most spiritual feeling that you ever felt? And I kind of would like to go around, Randy, if you want to share yours or you've got another question.
Well, I had a question. I was like, what did you do with that experience when you had your faith crisis? How did you deal with it?
You know, to be honest, that one was the most difficult one because it was the most unmistakable, undeniable, profound one. And it had to deal with simply the existence of God. I tend to believe that these experiences are self-generated. I mean, if you could really probe into my psyche at that moment, there was a lot of fear, there was a lot of stress, there was a lot of uncertainty, and I just wanted to feel some comfort. I wanted to feel like everything was going to be okay. I wanted to feel like the path that I was on, that I was going in the right direction, I was going to do the right, and that I wasn't going to have to make some big change and, you know, announce to my family, oh, wait, I've decided I'm not going on a mission. You know what I'm saying? So what I'm saying, like, everything inside me wanted that experience. And I think that when we want something bad enough, we can create that experience.
Or tap into that part of the brain.
Right. Yeah. It seems like the positive the upsides of a neurological experience are kind of proportional to the downsides of the stakes that
right.
are at the point at which you make that experience. And that is similar to my experience. My experience was actually one of my most powerful spiritual experiences was pre-mission as well. It was on the Father's Day prior to me. It was after I graduated from high school and before I went on my mission, I was like sending my papers and stuff. And I just, I was thinking about my dad a lot who had passed away, and I had this very visceral feeling of connection to him. Like he was, you know, physically in proximity to me, you know, and it was, I think that it was proportional to the angst and fear that I was feeling at the time. I mean, I still think fondly on that experience, and I still look to it as an important moment in my life. I just don't view it as evidence of metaphysical reality in the same way that I used to.
Yeah.
That's funny how, wait, Jake, was yours mission related?
Yeah, pre-mission, yeah. I was thinking a lot about. I mean, I was about to go into BYU for my first semester, and I was getting ready to send in my mission papers and stuff, and so.
That's funny because I'm going to make it 3 for 3, but mine was inside the MTC, and I think I've told this story before, but the MTC is really intense, and it can freak you out, and I was sort of freaking out, going. Same thing. Fuck. Okay.
Wait.
That doesn't help.
13 minutes and 30 seconds.
Okay. So Space Cowboy. Some people call me the. Alluded to this thing.
Nice save.
Yeah. So Space Cowboy alluded to the same angst. You know, I'd better know this is true. Because I'm freaking out with this 10 hours of crazy classes and all this testosterone, and so I was praying. I did the Moroni's promise and I got dick for like a week,
that's a bad thing, right?
Yeah. Dick meaning nothing.
Got okay. Dick for a week.
Yeah, right. And I said that right after saying testosterone.
Yeah.
But they had this, one of those big firesides that they have in the MTC that are, these huge halls. And they played this kind of a collage of scenes from church videos of Jesus. And they played this really schmaltzy, I think it might have been Janis Cap Perry, His Hands. And it was more than just one song, but it was really emotionally manipulative. And my body started to quake and I started to cry uncontrollably, and it lasted for, I never had anything last like that for very long, and it lasted for what seemed like 10 minutes. That's probably how long the video was, and that is
quite a reaction to dick. Wow.
I tell you, my dick's never lasted 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Damn straight. I'd cramp up. So yeah, that was so far and away. I even wrote down the experience. The mission president, when I left the mission, said, write down your most spiritual experience on your mission. And then that was the experience I chose. And I wrote it for my mom, and she just ate it up. But it was a real emotional, I don't even know what word to use for it. It was quite the phenomenon. And I basically got, when I dealt with it the same way Space Cowboy did.
All right, Heather.
Wait, is yours in the MTC as well?
Are you asking me?
Yes, I am.
Why? You want to align your story with mine?
Right.
No, I just want to make sure all the MTCs go together.
Mine is not in the MTC.
Okay. Neither's mine. I had the burning in the bosom experience. The full-on caloric heat inside my chest, like visceral swelling feeling that continued and pulsated for some time. And this was, I was 11 years old, and I had just finished reading the Book of Mormon. I was talking about it with my mom.
Whoa, 11, that is young.
Yeah.
I was just bored at 11.
I wanted to know, when I was 8, my mom had signed me up to be baptized, and I was like so worried about it. I got out of bed at night and was like, Mom, I can't get baptized. I don't have a testimony. And she was like, you're getting baptized. Go to bed. So,
don't worry about it. No one else does.
Yeah, but I did. I worried about it. I wanted to know.
Yeah. So mine was not in the MTC, but it was like the other guys here.
Mine wasn't in the MTC.
It was mission related.
Okay, yeah. It was mission related.
I'm just saying, like the other guys, was mission related. Mine was when I had my stake president at the time, who 2 years ago was busted for soliciting prostitutes. By the way, just as a side note, I love throwing that in.
Two years ago?
Yeah, I think it was 2 years ago. Maybe it was a summer ago, something like that.
I saw his picture. He's old.
Yeah, yeah. And I read the police report. It was awesome. But anyway, he was laying his hands on my head, setting me apart as a missionary and telling me how awesome I was and that Jesus really wanted me to know how awesome I was and all the things that Jesus had prepared in the mission field for me. And it was like Randy described, just my body was shaking and, you know, tears streaming out. And I went and I wrote down the experience in my journal right afterwards, and I still have it, and it's so embarrassing. So
I still it's have
like,
it too.
It's my, like my feeble frame cannot, you know, it's like cannot contain the great power and blessings that God has prepared for me. You know? So but yeah, touching. it was a very spiritual thing. And I would say I was probably one of those people who did feel the Spirit quite frequently, or you know, felt that emotion, had those feelings, and it wasn't anything that I really ever had that epistemological crisis, you know, like Heather described. Like I recognized, okay, there are times where I'm feeling this and it's outside of it, but I was always able to compartmentalize it, I guess, and think, well, this is the Spirit confirms the truth and beauty of all things. Maybe that was how I did it. I don't know. So that wasn't a stumbling block for me at all. But so anyways, back to Space Cowboy then. Some people. So we've all had these kinds of spiritual experiences. It did change a little bit for you, you mentioned, during your faith crisis. And then how'd you go from being a 10 on the Space Cowboy Mormon cred scale to taking mushrooms?
Well... well, I'm assuming you don't want this to be as long as the story that it would take to answer that in full, so I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. Faith crisis, tried for years to regain my testimony, wasn't able to regain my testimony, finally came to the moment where I said, maybe the reason why I can't get it to add up and I can't get my testimony back is it's not a problem with me, it's a problem with the church. And switched to open-ended prayers to regain my testimony. I'd been praying, like, please give me back my testimony of Joseph Smith. Please give me back my testimony of the church and the prophet and all that. Like, I was telling God what I wanted him to do. And I finally thought, well, maybe you should just pray open-ended prayers, like, lead me to truth and away from error.
Oh, that's a big mistake, because the Lord's bound when you do what he says. So as long as you're doing what he says, you can dictate to him what he's going to do for you.
Yeah, so I started praying open-ended prayers, and that seemed to be a pretty significant shift, because from then on out, I just saw more and more reasons it wasn't true, and, you know, if anything, it only increased how often it was confirmed to me that the problem isn't with you, the problem is with, you know, the fundamental truth claims, they just don't add up, they're not there. And I, ultimately, where I landed was, I guess you could say atheist. Although I never embraced the atheist label, because there's a lot of confusion and baggage and misunderstanding around the word atheist. Like, to most people, if you say, I'm an atheist, they incorrectly assume that what that means is you're one of those know-it-alls that is somehow omniscient, that somehow knows, like, for scientific fact that there's no God. And of course, I assume all of us on this phone call know that that's a total misunderstanding. But nonetheless, that is what the common misunderstanding of the atheist label is. I feel like, you know, to be honest, intellectually honest, you always have to be cognizant of the limitations of the human mind and human perception and reason, and you always have to at least hold out a theoretical possibility that there is something, but at the same time just say we don't have conclusive evidence that such a thing exists, right? So I would call myself an agnostic, but really it was no different than being an atheist.
All that's is, you know, absolutely true. But I take a little bit different approach. I own that word, and I wear it.
I know you do.
All my staff knows that I'm atheist, and the reason why I want to do it is I want to take the word back.
Yeah.
And I want people to know an atheist and know that he's actually a decent guy. But you know, that might be a pipe dream. But
so you have to pretend to be decent all day long.
I know. It's such a drag.
Yeah.
It's like being a Mormon now.
It's all about the public perception, right? You don't want to be the person who gives atheist the bad name.
Right. Like, you're an emissary of atheists.
Yes, everyone is looking at you, and when they see that you're smiling, they know that you know something.
Everybody's watching.
That's a twinkle in my eye.
Dr. Snyder, you just seem like such a great guy. What is it that gives you?
Well, I'll tell you.
It's my belief in the everlasting void of nothingness that awaits us.
The eternal dial tones.
Atheism! Bringing joy to everyone! Let's shoot it.
Sorry to hijack it, Space Cowboy.
No, it's okay. I should add something, though, Glenn. I just dawned on me that, you know, what I just ended with is incomplete, because you asked, you know, how did I go from, you know, 10 out of 10 on the TBM scale to magic mushrooms? I mean, first, obviously, was the loss of faith that brought down my barriers to controlled substances and alcohol and things like that. But
what was your view of controlled substances and alcohol before?
Oh, they're bad. They're evil. Oh, yeah. I mean, my experience with alcohol was limited to, like, you know, two crazy weekends in high school. And I was so guilt-ridden about it that the next week I was in my bishop's office bawling, like crying with guilt, you know, confessing it. So I had very extremely minimal experiences even with alcohol.
That's an interesting thing about Mormon, kind of the Mormon psychology. Alcohol is such an obvious, or the word of wisdom is such an obvious outward indicator of whether or not you're in the tribe. So it actually gets weighted stronger than it really is doctrinally in the church. Like when I was at BYU, this girl that was my best friend's girlfriend's roommate, so I was over there a lot, and she was, and her other roommates were just talking, they were so righteously indignant about so and so who they saw smoking. Oh my God, mm-hmm. Can you believe that? Well, guess what? Like the next week, she's in the bishop's office for getting oral sex.
Right.
And in the Mormon doctrine, I mean, it's not even close, but you can socially, some people will view like drinking alcohol as equal to having sex.
Or worse. No, the next kind of big key piece that kind of moved me, you know, in the direction of mushrooms is during my whole faith crisis, which involved a significant amount of marital conflict and family conflict, I got in a really bad depression, like a terribly bad depression. And I started taking an antidepressant. That is the first time I had ever, you know, done anything like that. And day three of taking them, they kicked in. And it was a night and day difference. And I went from suicidal depression to Leonardo DiCaprio on the bow of the Titanic, you know, feeling like the king of the world. And at that point, I realized the power and the importance of brain chemistry, that just altering the levels of even just one chemical, or in this case, one neurotransmitter in your brain makes a night and day difference in your perception of reality. in your mood, in your level of happiness, etc. Sorry, go ahead, Jake.
No, I like that you said that you mentioned the importance of brain chemistry. Was that something that kind of undermined your confidence in quote unquote spiritual experiences or experiences like the one that you had in the MTC? Because understanding how fragile brain chemistry is and how much our perception of the world, I mean, it's entirely determined by brain chemistry.
Right.
Or I mean, I guess there's some physiology in there as well, but it was a lot more difficult to hang on to the idea of these spiritual experiences being these kind of pillars of truth and nothing else could have brought this about. You know, this is the only explanation is divine intervention. When I understood how fragile brain chemistry is, it really undermined that mentality or that paradigm.
Absolutely. There's a funny story that goes right to that, which is, I talked to a friend, an LDS friend, about my whole faith crisis thing, and you know how I just couldn't feel it was true anymore. I just didn't feel like it was true anymore, and he just kind of shrugged his shoulders and kind of dismissed it and said, it's just a change in body chemistry. You're just getting older. Like our body chemistry changes as we age, and you're just getting older, and your body chemistry is changing." So I later told that, you know, retold that conversation to my stake president when I was telling him about my faith crisis and everything. And he said, "Well, maybe it is just body chemistry." And I said, "Yeah, I've thought about that, but what does that say about the spiritual experiences that have been the foundation of my testimony my whole life? Like it's not a testimony reinforcing idea to say that this all boils down to body chemistry. Like whether or not you believe in the church boils down to body chemistry. Like that's not faith promoting. No, that would be what's called a naturalistic explanation."
Interesting, because that actually, I feel like that really undermines the experience that Heather had, because like as an 11-year-old, having an experience like that is probably a lot less unlikely than having that experience as like a 40-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's wild.
I mean, what a few of the other things, Glenn, that kind of moved me along the primrose path towards psilocybin was there was a report that I came across that was commissioned by the British government. The British government several years ago wanted to overhaul their criminal penalties for the possession and sale of controlled substances. They basically wanted to make sure that the punishments fit the crime, to make sure that the punishments were proportional to the degree of harmfulness of the substances. And so what they did is they commissioned pharmacologists, doctors, social workers to review the harmful effects of all controlled substances, both in terms of the harm to the user and the harm to society, and then to rank them on a scale of 1 to 100, the 100 being the 100 being the most harmful. And things, as you would, as you would predict, drugs like meth and heroin were like way up there, like in the 80s. Alcohol, I just remember being surprised how high alcohol was. I think alcohol was actually in the 60s or 70s. But I noticed the thing that stuck with me was I was curious. Okay, what's at the very bottom of the list? At the very bottom of the list, registering a 5 out of 100 with psilocybin mushrooms. And that just kind of stuck with me when I saw that I had never tried any illegal drugs, but I just kind of stored that away in my memory that if I'm ever going to go that route, mushrooms is probably a good safe way to go. But then what got me interested in mushrooms was, you know, anyone who's paying attention to like science news these days, there's been within the last 5 years quite a few articles about how scientific testing of psilocybin mushrooms and other psychedelics is being renewed on a small scale both in Europe and the United States. And what they're finding so far is very interesting. There's things like they've got benefits for treating post-traumatic stress disorder. They're also effective in curing addiction. And, yeah, OCD. And another thing that was very interesting to me is that many participants reported having spiritual experiences. And later, like even when they did follow-up, you know, questioning of the test participants, they described their experience with mushrooms as being one of the most profound, important, meaningful events of their entire life. And remember that?
Yeah, there's. I mean, I've been reading a little bit, or I have read some summaries from a John Hopkins study that was done.
Yes.
I don't know if it's the same study, but I think they've done two or three at this point. But yes, that it was one of the most profound, even months after the fact, it was one of the
That's
most
right.
profound experiences of their lives.
That's right. And people were reporting that they had like a boost in just their overall mood and contentment in life. They were reporting this even months afterwards. And so that, of course, piqued my interest. Another thing that piqued my interest was, I don't know if you guys have seen the documentary on Netflix about DMT. Have you seen that? They call it like the God drug or the God chemical or something like that, because people who take DMT report having spiritual experiences, like that they just sense divinity and they feel the presence of God. And doing a little more research, I found out that entheogens or psychedelics, and when I say that, I'm talking about psilocybin mushrooms, LSD, mescaline. Mescaline is the active ingredient in peyote and in San Pedro cacti. That these psychedelics are extremely similar to DMT in their chemical composition. They all seem to be like in this related family, and so that kind of piqued my interest. And
did you learn anything about the a dark side? Because, you know, like heroin, from what I've heard, I will never ever, I'm never, not even close, attempted to try heroin ever, because it's the most addictive drug out there. But I've heard that it is just the most amazing experience you could ever have. But then the dark side is that you're going to die.
Right.
From a drug overdose.
Yeah, it's, in terms of psilocybin mushrooms, I mean, remember, they're ranked, you know, 5 out of 100. Let's talk about it, like the addictiveness of them. That's one of the really interesting things about psilocybin mushrooms, is that you can't become addicted and you can't become like a frequent long-term user, because interestingly, our body builds up a tolerance to them so rapidly that they just stop working. Like you couldn't do magic. If you ate magic mushrooms every day for 2 weeks, they would stop working in week two.
For the rest of your life?
No. If you go a long period, when I say long, I mean like, I don't know, several months. If you go 6 months, if you go, you know, they become active again.
Okay, like, so it's not like permanent damage. It's just the tolerance wears off.
Right.
Randy, I think you might need to rethink heroin, because I think you're going off of old information about the actual addictiveness of heroin. I'm serious. So
really?
It was, yeah, the, yeah. The studies
it,
in the
Randy.
70s.
I need to, okay.
The studies in the
Again,
70s.
Again, tell me more.
The needles are very safe these days.
Folks.
Okay, go.
I'm about to tell you
All right. Stop a truth bomb. Drop a truth bomb on our face.
No, according to Wikipedia, go ahead.
I'm not on Wikipedia, and I hope I get this right. So I think it's the studies in the 70s about heroin, where they had the rats in the cages, and they had one button to press for heroin and one button to press for water, and the rats would get so addicted to heroin that they would press the water and die of thirst and starvation, because they wouldn't press the food. Sorry, it's food and water. So then everyone started to think, oh, heroin is the most addictive substance in the world. Those studies were recently redone within the past several years, where the researchers said, well, why was he just in a cage? Why were the rats just in a cage with nothing else there? So they created like rat Disney World with
sugar.
sugar, all sorts of things to play with, mazes, friends to hang out with, female bats to have sex with. Yes, the works. And also the food button, the food and water button, and the heroin button. And the rats didn't even use the heroin.
Well, then they never got addicted.
No, I mean, they tried it, and then they would give it up.
Oh, they tried it. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Right. I remember looking at that study where it was like the cause of addiction is isolation and lack of connectedness in a social, you know, like.
That's right. Yeah. And so, which causes us to rethink the way that we treat addiction with rehab and isolation.
Right.
But anyway, so what I want to say to you, Randy, is look into it before you say
it. Don't just dismiss it willy-nilly is what you're
saying. Be open-minded. Come on.
I'm with Randy on this one. You've never, there's certain substances, and heroin's one of them, that I have absolutely no interest in experimenting with even once, because you've just heard so many stories that are that you know that it's a dead-end street. Like, you've never heard a story that said, Bob was really down in the dumps, but then he started heroin or coke or meth. And then as he became a success and his marriage improved and he got a promotion at work and his kids liked him more. Like, you just never heard a story like that.
It's about a rat, though.
If we're invoking Bob for that story, could we give a percentage?
Sorry, I forgot.
Actually, I saw an interesting documentary about that very thing that happened. It was Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, that was a good documentary.
And he really came out. He was really doing well. I think he was a very responsible citizen.
Well, but yeah. Even before that documentary was made, he was standing on the bow of a ship saying that he was the king of the world. So
right. So actually becoming a business mogul was a step down from king of the world.
I was just saying, I wasn't really basing it on the rat study. I was basing it on a friend of mine was he was an addiction. Therapist, and he was citing, you know, he knew this is his field, so he knew that some stats, and just while we were golfing once, he said something about the number of people that use heroin more than once is like 90%, and he cited some other stats that he put heroin at the top of like the worst thing you could ever try to get into, and I know from my pharmacology classes that opiates are highly addictive to humans.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm not really compelled by rats.
We can have a heroin episode another time, but okay. Right, I'm interested in the whole spirituality and shrooms thing.
Well, edit it out then.
Well, I got a good segue for you then, Glenn.
All right.
You guys might be interested. Well, I think you will be interested in this. So, have you all read the paper? It's like some sort of academic paper that advances the hypothesis that Joseph Smith used entheogens, like magic mushrooms, and that basically is what explains his visions and other, you know, sort of supernatural experiences.
I'm glad you brought that up. I don't remember it being an academic paper, but I remember several years ago finding a website, and it was the guy Lumen Walters that introduced it to him. Am I remembering that right?
That name doesn't ring a bell. You might be right. I just don't remember the guy's name. I will, not to jump ahead, but too much, but I completely and totally dismissed that theory the first time I read that paper. And then after my experience with mushrooms, I had to go back and read that paper again. Because it gained a lot of credibility, like, through the mushroom experience.
Like, that paper, did it talk about the Kirtland experience, that there was something like the wine was laced with that, so the visions that people were seeing, like, 100 tongues of flame and...
That's the theory.
Yeah.
That's the theory.
All right.
Because psilocybin mushrooms, according to that paper anyway, have been found in the Sacred Grove.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, that's not really surprising. I mean, they're pretty common. They grow just about everywhere, if you know how to identify them. But here's something you might find interesting is, in doing some internet research, and we know it's not true because I found it on the internet, but take it for what it's worth. There's this theory that manna is referring to psilocybin mushrooms. And before you laugh...
Too late.
go back and read the account of the description of manna, because it fits psilocybin mushrooms. What it says is it's small, it's white, it's round, it's found on the ground. It's white, it's round, it's found on the ground. It's white, round, found on the ground.
Don't call me the gangster of love.
It's white, it's round, it's found on the ground. Okay, so far you're like, yeah, it's... But, melts in the sun. You ever see what happens to mushrooms in the sun? Like, they wither.
Yeah.
And magic mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms, they assuage your hunger. Like, they take away your hunger.
So
I'm not kidding.
So are you suggesting that the manna that God provided to the Israelites during the Exodus from Egypt was actually the magic mushrooms? Or are you saying that this bullshit story that never happened
exactly.
Was this element of the story was inspired by magic mushrooms that the storytellers themselves knew about and so presented in the story that way?
A lot closer to the latter. The point being that there's quite a bit of research findings that indicate that entheogens were a big part of both primitive and ancient religions. And even into medieval times, if you look at I've seen examples of medieval Christian art where you see the Amanita muscaria, that's another type of mushroom that has psilocybin, you see that represented in religious art. And, for example, in the Rig Veda, they've got a soma ceremony, and it refers to the green tint of the soma. And then there's this, you know, sacramental prayer that you say to bless the soma. Soma was basically herbs whose juices had been pressed out and then mixed with milk. And they would say this prayer. And the funny thing about the prayer is that the end of each line is, "and make us happy." You know, please bless this soma to give us visions, give us insight, give us wisdom, unlock the secrets, you know, the mysteries of the universe, and make us happy. I don't know about the nurturing and strengthening, but here's the punchline, is that ancient soma vessels have been unearthed in India, the residues inside tested, and they've found entheogenic substances along with cannabis, opium, and ephedra. And let me just put it to you this way. Doesn't that provide the most obvious naturalistic explanation for things like visions? I mean, I've never had a vision. Have any of you guys ever had a vision?
I mean,
you can make them up. You can, and legends can, you know, include visions.
Randy has seen spiders.
We all hallucinate even while we're awake a little bit, you know, or at least we see optical illusions. And people that are too high on that spectrum are schizophrenic. All this is perfectly fine and reasonable. The only thing I want to say about it is, damn, that's religion. I mean,
right?
Sacrament. If sacrament means instead of Wonder Bread and tap water, with soma and wine, I don't know.
You'd go back. Are you saying that's how they could get you back?
I'm saying that sounds like a really cool communal ritual.
I've got the church for you to join then, Randy.
Preach, brother.
No, for real. There's a Native American church. It's called like the Native American Christian Church or Native American Church of Christ. It's a Native American Christian church, but they take peyote together as a congregation for their sacrament.
It's like the Joseph Smith stratagem as well, to make people fast for days and then give them a bunch of wine. Let's have a joint spiritual experience.
Yeah. Right.
Hey, Glenn, do you remember me telling the story? Because I had a waking dream like in Kansas City, late Kansas City, so it was probably about 2 years ago.
Hang on. We're recording again, right?
Back on? Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
At Heather's comment is where I'm going to bring us back in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead, Randy.
Anyway, I was laying in bed, and But I had another waking dream.
Was this the time where you sent me the picture that you had the cowboy hat?
No, that was in Cancun.
Okay, all right.
But I was laying in bed, and then, you know, my eyes opened, but I'm paralyzed. And it wasn't a demon, but it was like an other. It was some supernatural being was coming in. And the thought that went through my head was, oh, my God, I am wrong.
Oh, yeah, you did tell me this. Yeah.
Materialism is wrong.
Right.
Oh, my. And then I snapped out of it, and I just started laughing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that is when you're at your most believing state, when you're in an altered state of mind. I agree with that.
So, Space Cowboy, you got to the point where controlled substances had been demystified for you or de-demonized right. for you. And even doing this research, looking and seeing that the mushrooms are actually not very dangerous at all. So you thought, I'm going to go find me a mushroom dealer. And you just like walked down the street and walked into different bars asking people for mushrooms. Was that your approach?
Almost. No, I mean, where I went with all this research, like the final thing that really motivated me was, you know, growing up LDS, I'd heard all about visions, right? You read about people having visions in the Bible and visions in the Book of Mormon, and visions are all over the Doctrine and Covenants. And I had never had a vision. I had never had an experience where I saw something, you know, that only I saw and that was just totally compelling and real. And I just was intensely curious to find out. Like, I had never hallucinated. I had never seen something that wasn't there. And I was just fascinated by this idea that if you just alter your brain chemistry a little bit, you can see things. And it was a news article. I think the last news article that really kind of pushed me over the edge to say, okay, let's do this, was an article that explained that the scientists have discovered how psilocybin works. You know why it is that you hallucinate on the psilocybin. What it does is it activates the part of your brain that is typically only active when you're dreaming. So in essence, all it's doing is enabling you to experience it at the same time, both being consciously, you know, awake, seeing the external world, but then overlaying on top of that a dreamscape that your mind is creating. Make sense? So it kind of made it less intimidating to me. This is, we dream every night, we hallucinate every night in our sleep. What if you could take that ability, that power, and experience that while you're awake and your eyes are wide open? And I wanted to experience that. I wanted to see what it was like. I did not.
So even there, I mean, because I don't think that the whole controlled substance demystification or de-demonization has completely happened for me, because there's still like these stories that I heard as a kid where people get something that's laced with angel dust or PCP, and then they go jumping out of a window because they think they can fly and, you know, ha-ha, don't use drugs kind of thing. So, like, even in the case where you're talking about mushrooms, if you're starting to see things or, like, you're projecting the dreamscape onto life, like, do you know what's real or not real? Or is it like in The Hunger Games where PETA's like, real, not real?
Well, here's what I discovered. Like, I expected the hallucinations, the visuals, to be a lot more intense. Like, I expected and wanted to see, I wanted to, like, look out my eyes and see, like, a Dali painting, you know? Like, the clocks folding and melting, and, like, I just wanted everything to just be totally tripped out. And that's what I was expecting, was really powerful visuals like that. And as I discovered, it's not like that.
Did you see the episode of Mad Men when they trip
the
on
LSD?
Acid?
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about that too, yeah.
LSD is not for kids. I did not see that episode of Mad Men, but I don't know if we're going to have time and if you're going to have the interest to go into LSD, but I can tell you that, like, psilocybin is okay for kids. LSD is for grown-ups, like, That is serious stuff.
All right. Well, let's do the mushrooms story first, and we'll see where we're at with the LSD.
Kid-friendly mushrooms.
Kid-friendly mushrooms, yeah.
I did not go down to my corner mushroom dealer. I got them from a friend who got them from a friend. You know, it always works like that, right?
Yeah. And then when you did it for the first time, were you with somebody who was experienced? You know, like, so describe the process of setting it up. And, you know, like, people can have good experiences or they can have bad experiences.
Right.
Like, how do you make this the best possible experience and not the worst one? Because you've experienced both, right?
Right. And yeah, this is the perfect segue to talk about the importance of set and setting. By the way, a tremendous online resource about the world of psychedelic mushrooms is shroomery.org. And this is where I picked up a little bit of the lingo, but they talk about set and setting. Both are very important. Your set is like your mindset. Like, what's your mood? Are you stressed out? Are you depressed? Are you angry? Because, you know, as you would expect, much of the experience is basically just a reflection of what's inside you, right? And then your setting is sort of the external factors. So let me tell you about the external factors of how we set it up the first time, which ended up being like an amazing, incredible, sublime, life-changing experience. First thing you want is you want a babysitter. You want a chaperone, you know, a designated non-mushroom doer. Because on the off chance that you get all paranoid or you start wigging out, you want, it's going to be comforting for you to know that there's someone who's totally sober that if need be, they can help you.
So that's like a, that would be a huge thing for me if I was to ever do it. Because like my fear, Space Cowboy, is that that I'm so filled.
You know, every time I hear Space Cowboy, I'm going to edit in the
some people call me the Space Cowboy.
Oh, that's going to be awesome.
It's going to get old.
I'm so filled with anxiety in my set,
right,
that I would be so afraid that the hallucinations won't be comforting. And I won't be capable of keeping a grip on things. And I mean, is that something that I mean, that has to happen a lot, right? People freaking out.
It depends on the setting. Like, I'll go through, there's a few more factors, but also dosage is hugely important, because it's like anything else. Like, if you have a few drinks, you're going to be okay. But if you were to drink a gallon of alcohol, well, now you've got alcohol poisoning. It's the same thing with the dosage with psilocybin mushrooms. Like, if you take a mild or moderate dose, you're going to be okay. If you take too much, though, it's not going to be it's going to be a bad trip. It's not going to be a good experience. But you want a babysitter. The first time I had a babysitter, the first time was awesome. The second time was my most horrific, terrifying experience of my life. I did not have a babysitter. So that, I think, was an important component.
Were you alone the second time?
No, I was with a buddy.
Yeah.
But he was like, he was on Jupiter. And so he was gonna be no help.
He's like, I can take care of the dragons flying around your head, but I don't know about angst. I don't know what to do with that.
What was that like when it was just the two of you and you were both tripping? It was a bad experience for you, but it was a good experience for him. Like, are you able to communicate at all, or are you just totally out of?
You can communicate, but it's laborious. So.
You just want to be in your own head.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I was going with the next step, which is you really want to be laying down in a lounge chair. Like, I've been in all, bodily positions under the influence of mushrooms, standing up, sitting down, laying down. You want to be laying down because it takes over. And if you're standing up you know, if you're moving, if you're even sitting up, it can seem to, I don't know the way to put it, like you just struggle. You can just struggle because you're just in no position to be standing up or moving or doing anything. You really just want to be able to lay down in a lounge chair. And for me, I think another huge component of why the first time was so good was I was outdoors. I was in my buddy's backyard, laying on a lounge chair and just looking up at the sky, because you want to look at something that's kind of like a blank canvas that then your brain can project its dreamscape onto. And for me, all the magic happened in the sky. And then the other thing you want is music. Like music, I realized that was another big difference between my first and second experience. When you've got music, particularly a carefully selected playlist of songs that are attached to good memories, you know, that put you in a good mood, you'll find that you're getting lost in the music. You're getting immersed in the music in a way. You know, like back in junior high and high school where you would connect with a song so much that it would, like, you would feel the song with every fiber of your being? Am I the only one who felt that way?
Yeah, when I listened to The Cure, When a Girl Dumped Me.
Okay. All right, so maybe in a sad sense, but what I'm saying is I think in junior high and high school, our body chemistry is more inclined towards enthusiasm in general, right? And so, like, when you're into something, you're, like, really into it. Like, I experienced getting into music in a way that I felt like I hadn't been into music like that since, like, junior high or high school. Like, I was just swept away, just carried away by the music. And one of the interesting things I noticed was, and this is really cool, is I think they call this syncopation, where I started noticing that the sky would flash a different color. In my case, it was, like, a violet or magenta color. It would flash a different color with the beat, and that was really cool.
See, I can only relate this to when I've been in the dentist and I've got the nitrous oxide going, and I put on the music, and then I just kind of like zone out because I don't even want to know. I don't want to hear the
right.
You know,
right?
Do you ever do? I mean, have you done that? Is it a similar thing with the music? Because that's where I feel like I really connect with the music and just kind of love it.
You want something that you can pay attention to that isn't intimidating. So like music is a pretty good candidate for that. You can just, all you have to do is lay there and listen and you'll just become totally absorbed. Like I can't imagine trying to watch a movie or watch a TV show on mushrooms. You can't process anything like that. You need something intangible and, you know, ethereal like music to just kind of get lost in.
So Space Cowboy, right? What is your I want to know what your trip playlist is. Like what are the best songs that you've used?
Okay, so I started out really campy, like, and corny, like on purpose. I started with Age of Aquarius.
That is corny.
And then went into some Beatles, like, you know, Yellow Submarine, Octopus's Garden, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Then I went into either some Doors or some Pink Floyd.
So you're sticking with, like, the drug, the height of the drug music.
Yeah, you gotta be careful. It seems like you'd have to be careful with the Doors.
My OCD.
Jim could take you to some dark places.
Well, I didn't have The End on the playlist. But the Crystal Ship, you know, that's legit.
Did you ever use The Cure, I Will Always Love You?
Right.
I did not have any Cure on there.
Junior high school breakups.
I did not have any Cure. I had some, I had some Cake, some Pixies, some Luna. I don't know if you guys know some of these bands. Pavement. You guys know Pavement?
So, Space Cowboy.
Yes.
I can't remember the question after Space Cowboy.
If you'd like, I can walk you through chronologically the experience, like from taking it, like from start to finish. You want me to do that?
Time keeps on slipping, slipping.
20-minute mark, all of a sudden they kicked in. And when they kick in hard. They take over. And I just locked my eyes on the sky, and I was looking at the clouds, and all of a sudden, the clouds started to morph into these intricate shapes that I didn't know how to describe, and they just morphed almost like they had snowflake edges, and they were just morphing and shifting and changing. And as time went on, I noticed that they were being guided by the music, that the movement of the clouds and the changing of the clouds and everything was following the tempo of the music. And at the same time, the blue sky is flashing like a magenta or a violet whenever the, you know, the bass drum hits in the song. And I kept telling my friends, like, shut up, like, stop talking, like, watch what's going on in the sky. Look at that. Do you guys see that? And I say that, like, to point out that even though before I took the mushrooms, I knew that I was going to see stuff that really wasn't there. When you're experiencing it, like, when you're seeing it, it feels 100% real. And I kept, like, hitting my friend's shoulder, like, be quiet, look at that, look at that. Like, it just seems like what you're seeing is really there. I didn't know how to describe the shapes that the clouds were taking. A few days later, I just Googled trippy clouds. And I found some images that matched what I saw. Because, like I said, I couldn't describe the shape of them. They were fractals. Like, the clouds, like, they turned into, like, fractal-like shapes and were moving and morphing the whole time. I also saw in the sky, you know, usually you look at the sky, it looks two-dimensional, right? It's just blue. It just looks flat, right? The sky somehow, like, became three-dimensional to me, and I saw these crisscrossing, like, beams arching across the sky, almost like it was some sort of structure holding up the sky. And while I'm watching these visuals, you experience like what my friends and I refer to as being like sucked in and then spit out. And what I mean by that is you get sucked into the experience, and while you're sucked in, you experience a loss of your ego. And when I say that, I mean a loss of feeling like you are a separate individual being, like a loss of a feeling that you're a separate person. And you just feel like you are just consciousness that is continuous with and completely integrated with everything around you. And you also lose a sense of being embodied. You lose a sense that you have a body. And that voice that's normally talking in your head is silent. And you just get totally, I don't know how to explain it. The only thing I've ever read that comes close is the way mystics, like religious mystics, talk about their, you know, experiences getting gnosis, where they lose the ego, they lose the feeling of being a separate individual, and they merge with the, you know, one great whole of reality. And you experience that when you get sucked in. Then what happens is you get sucked in. Who can say how long it is, because your sense of time gets greatly altered. But you get spit out, and then you're able to kind of try to process mentally what you just experienced.
How abrupt is the spit out process?
When you say abrupt, I mean, there's nothing jarring about it. It's like all of a sudden you kind of come to in a way. Like you're cognizant of the fact that the last 5, 10, 15 minutes you weren't really thinking about what was going on, and that now you're able to think about it. I gotta say, I feel like a fool when I try to explain this stuff, because, let me make a comparison. Whenever I would read any sort of literature by religious mystics, and they would talk about you know, this gnosis or this divine knowledge that goes beyond words and concepts, that, you know, you can't, that human language is inadequate to capture it. I thought that that was just a total cop-out. Like, come on, guys, you're just making this up, and you're just saying we can't explain it because you guys are full of it. With mushrooms, now I think I know exactly what they're talking about. Like, you just have this experience that when you come out of it, it's like, how do I even explain that? Like, how do I even put words to it?
You just reminded me of, like, the Brother Jared. He, like, went into one of those states and uttered words that cannot be written down.
Right. Right. Those are, maybe those are little white stones that God touched.
White, round, found on the ground. Snap. Yeah.
Wait, so, yeah, so,
go ahead, Jake.
Well, so this is interesting to me. I mean, when you're describing this experience or you're comparing it to religious mystics, in what ways does this kind of correlate with things that you experienced as a Mormon or under a religious paradigm? And in what ways does it differ or deviate from that?
Right. So what happened was while I'm the first thing I noticed when they kicked in was the visuals in the sky and the way the music was kind of orchestrating, you know, what was going on in the sky. But I basically spent the next 4 hours with my eyes locked on the sky. Like, I could not take my eyes off the sky because it was just so compelling and amazing what I was witnessing in the sky. And while that's happening, at some point into it, I want to say starting about a half hour into the visuals, all of a sudden, and again, this is where I'm at a loss for words, but I'll do my best to explain it. And I don't care if you guys laugh, because I would laugh too if someone told me this, because it would be nonsensical, but I had the distinct, like, overwhelming, undeniable sense that I was communing with the universe. And I know that doesn't make sense. Let me try to make it make a little sense. Like, the whole idea of communicating, like, heart to heart or spirit to spirit or mind to mind, I just felt like there was some cosmic intelligence in the universe that I was connected with, and we communed. And sometimes it was with words, but a lot of the time it was without words. And one of the things that came through to me in that communion with the universe was, and it's funny because it was very similar to my first, like, really profound spiritual experience, which was just an overwhelming feeling of love, that there was some intelligence in the universe that is aware of me, that cares about me, and that loves me.
That was a very John DeLynn 3 pattern right there. I just, like,
was it?
Yes.
Was it?
Yes. Okay. So you've been out in space, cowboy.
Good. Right.
Now everybody knows who you are, John DeLynn.
I guess I might as well come out and say Margie was my babysitter.
Margie.
Oh, yeah. Margie. You blew it. You blew it, space cowboy.
That's right, space cowboy.
And one of the thoughts that came distinctly to me that I thought the universe was telling me, that the way I was feeling right then, this sort of, like, enveloped in divine bliss, that that's what it was going to feel like when I died. And that the universe was telling me that when I died, it was going to take care of me and it was going to envelop me in that divine bliss and that I was going to be okay. And the thing that surprised me about all of this, and the reason why it was a spiritual experience and why it reignited my sense of spirituality, is that going into this experience, I didn't expect that. And I didn't have any, like, metaphysical beliefs that would cause me to... sure, I had my Mormon background, but at that point in time, I didn't believe in any sort of cosmic intelligence. And
are you saying then that you came out of it, and I'm not going to say something as strong as a belief in metaphysics, although maybe it is, but more of an openness towards it?
Yeah, yeah. And I'll tell you, one of my one of my close friends, one of my best friends, who is like a staunch atheist, it's rocked his world and it's opened his mind on these metaphysical questions, whereas his mind had been closed to those questions for a long time. Metaphysically, he was just a strict materialist.
I haven't taken this connection with the universe sacrament yet.
All you have to do is do that with John Hamer, and you're believing in God again. and you're getting baptized into...
I've already been baptized by Hamer.
What?
No, in that hot tub?
he's speaking...
Oh, it's a euphemism.
Yeah. It's similar to his MTC experience.
Yeah.
You got dick for a week.
Right, yeah. I was trying to be a little more subtle, but yeah.
So did you finish your story about the staunch atheist friend?
I'll get to him, but just to kind of round out, you know, what made this a spiritual experience, or why I even apply that word to this experience, is another huge thing that came through in that experience is this just overwhelming sense that life is a miracle. Like, the fact that we even exist, that we are sentient beings, that we're aware of ourselves and our place in the universe. I knew all of those things and thought all those things intellectually before this experience, but it turned those beliefs into more than just sort of an intellectual belief in my head, and turned it into a very profound, powerful, emotional belief. And I felt that life is amazing. This world, this universe is amazing. Like, it's incredible. It's so precious. And, you know, this is another place where I found myself conflicted, because the words I was wanting to use to describe the experience was, all of a sudden, nature, like the universe, life, it all became so sacred. It just seemed like it was so sacred. And when you feel that something's sacred, you have an incredible feeling of reverence and gratitude for it. And I remember at one point during the mushroom trip, you know, the thought occurred to me, you know, people kill each other. And that thought was just appalling to me. Like, how could someone take another human life? Like, human life is the most amazing, precious thing that there is. And that sort of sense has stayed with me ever since. And it's funny, because I don't have any like supernatural beliefs still to this day. And yet I so often feel when I'm, you know, out in nature and when I'm out and about, that nature is just, it's sacred, that there's, it made the universe, it made nature, it made life, it made it all sacred and divine to me. And I'm conflicted, because I don't even know what that means to say it's divine, because I don't have any supernatural beliefs. But the way I feel about it and the way I look at it, the only way I can explain it is I have to resort to my former like Mormon terminology of like sacred, divine.
Yeah, the thing I've like when I first became an atheist, the thing I liked first, which kind of, you know, became my mantra for finding meaning in my existence, is that I am the universe contemplating the universe.
Right.
How rare that is, but still, it's still just an abstract concept that really doesn't inspire me like the way you're describing going through this experience makes you feel about that same very notion. Of the, you know, I am the universe. I'm made from a supernova billions of years ago,
right?
And coalesced, and you know, to the Earth, and then evolution, and then, you know, me, the universe contemplating itself.
Yeah, I mean, the best way I can explain it is it will convert all those intellectual beliefs that you just stated. It will convert them into convert it into emotion that then becomes conviction.
So Space Cowboy, how do you reconcile the illegality of what it is that you're promoting. Because you're now a shroom missionary, right? You're a mishroomary.
A shroomy.
Mishroomary.
I hope they call me on a mushroom.
You prepared that.
No.
A proselytizer.
I was trying to get to it before Jake did.
No, I was behind the curve. Oh, well.
Yeah, no. I'm definitely a proselytizer of psilocybin now. I have very little respect for authority in general, and that like includes government. So I just don't really care that. I mean, this is a naturally occurring substance. This is a fungus. It's a mushroom. Like the idea to me that a group of people that call themselves the government can throw people in jail for ingesting or selling or cultivating like a naturally occurring substance like a mushroom or a plant, I just think it's crazy. So I don't care at all about the illegality of it.
But you've still got a job. I mean, people who are listening to this go, okay, this is a pretty articulate person. This isn't like Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. You know, the kind of like stoner pothead that
I am so you might wasted.
Have, yeah, that you like have a stereotype of the people who would do mushrooms, you know. So you must worry, or I don't know, I would think of losing, you know, that there's some kind of a risk professionally, maybe in your personal life, maybe to health, but all of those things are outweighed by the benefit that you've...
Yeah, I mean, what happens in my friend's backyard stays in my friend's backyard. And, you know, as long as my voice is sufficiently disguised on this podcast, I mean, the probability or the risk of someone finding out that I, you know, did this is, I mean, pretty remote in my estimation. But, you know, long story short, from this point on, I mean, and here's where my buddy and I that I was doing this with, we were on the same page. It was around sunset. I mean, wow. Anyone doing this, it would be good to time it so that you get to watch the sunset when you know, the mushrooms are still working. I mean, you'll never see a more incredible sunset in your life. And the sorts of feelings and thoughts that my buddy and I were having was, it's okay, I know you're going to laugh, but I mean, this is sincerely the way we felt, was that it was the most important day of our life, the most important experience of our life, and that our entire life, that the whole purpose of our entire life
was to experience that moment.
Was to, yes. It was all just foreplay.
Okay, I'm laughing.
No, I don't care, and I get it. It doesn't hurt my feelings, because if I had ever heard this from someone before, and I hadn't experienced it, I'd laugh my ass off. But I can't explain to you guys what the taste of salt is. If you haven't experienced it.
Right.
Oh, Elder Space Cowboy.
Elder Space.
And it reignited my spirituality in the sense that, and I'm not going to go through the long story, but a few months later, I joined a spiritual community, and I don't want to give the name of it, because it you know, could potentially give away my identity, but that is something that I never, ever, ever, ever in a million years thought I would ever do again. When I was an atheist / agnostic, I had like zero interest in church shopping or finding a replacement spiritual community, like zero. But what this experience did for me was I wanted to find some way to kind of prolong that feeling I had towards the universe and life and nature and other people. The sacredness of it, the divinity of it, the, you know, the reverence for it, the gratitude for it. I wanted to find some way to prolong it. And the only thing I could kind of, like, the closest thing I could associate with the experience was some sort of, like, spiritual setting. And I found an awesome spiritual community that is 180, it's, like, as different as a spiritual community could possibly be from Mormonism. Like, it is, like, 180 degrees, like, different than Mormonism, which made me feel you know, comfortable enough with them to join up with them.
I've heard that you don't want to be outdoors. Like, you don't want to be hiking in the woods and do this because there's too many, like, shadows that can be misinterpreted, too many animal noises, tree forms. Do you think that there's something to that? Or, you know, because you said you want to be, didn't you say you just want to be laying down and looking up at the sky?
You want above all to feel comfortable. And yeah, I can see that if, you know, you're like out in the forest, how, you know, maybe you might feel uncomfortable. I recommend, like, you know, a backyard. Because I do think that you're going to get better visuals outdoors than you could ever get indoors. I've never gotten good visuals indoors. All of the visuals I've experienced were outdoors. But let me just say that the visuals that I described, like the clouds taking different shapes, and, you know, seeing like kind of arching beams holding up the sky, you know, that's nothing like a Dali painting. You know, still to this day, even with LSD, I've never experienced, like, I shouldn't say never, just before my bad trip kicked in, I can explain that. Those were the most intense visuals I've had.
What were your visuals in the bad trip?
The bad trip, can I first explain the difference in setting? Because I think this really goes to what makes the difference between a good and a bad trip. First of all, for the bad trip, this was the second time. It was just me and a buddy. We did not have a babysitter. I was on an empty stomach rather than a full stomach. And I accidentally took about double what I took the first time. And when I say accidentally, it's because the first time the mushrooms had been ground up and then put in like little clear capsules. And the source that provided the mushrooms to us told us that these capsules were smaller than the first ones, and that's why they were twice as that they were half the size as the first capsules, and so that we needed to take twice as many capsules as the first time. And I'm convinced that our source was wrong, that the capsules the second time were not half the size. They were maybe like three quarters the size. But I think I took way too much on an empty stomach without a babysitter. And my buddy and I were just sitting in my backyard in a couple lounge chairs. I think that's another thing, honestly, was that we were sitting up instead of laying down. And at first when they kicked in, it was pretty awesome. Like, one of the clouds morphed into the face of like a Roman god or like a Roman Caesar. You know, I was experiencing the same sort of syncopation where the sky was flashing a different color with the beat of the music. But where it got really cool was I look over at my buddy, and he's like laying with his head back on the chair, eyes closed, like he's in another universe. And he looked like a faun, you know, like Mr. Tumnus. Like with hooves for feet and everything. And the fence, I know, it's awesome, right? And the fence behind him, every plank of the fence was a peacock feather. And then looking at my house, like, I've got stucco on the outside of the house. I don't think that's too much of a giveaway. And the stucco on the side of my house was like melting and dripping down the walls of the outside of my house like wax, like candle wax. And then there was this one song, and Glenn, I'll give it to you so that you can insert it right here. There's this one song that when you hear it, you'll understand why this is what I saw. My house was like inhaling and exhaling. Like, my house was like puffing up, like breathing in and then breathing out.
It's like the house of Usher. It's a sentient being now.
Right. And I'll give you the song because you'll get it. And then the last awesome visual I remember before it got bad, and this was really cool. Everything I saw was pixelated. Everything looked like vibrating dots. like the leaves of the trees, my house, like everything looked like it was comprised of vibrating pixelated dots.
You know what you got to do? You got to record yourself, videotape yourself, just to look how stupid you look. Your face is all duh.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure it is.
My life is changing right there. You see that?
I'm sure it is.
It's blowing.
I experienced transcendence in the universe. Right.
Right, right.
That, see where the drool drips? Oh,
right there, right there, right there. That stroke face right there that I have.
Exactly. No, it's my O face. It's my O face sustained for 4 hours. So, should I talk about when it gets bad and what that's like?
Sure,
of course.
Okay, so what happens is, I blame my bad trip also on the fact that the music stopped. Because the music stopped, and like the music is like on the other side of my yard, like across the pool. And I just didn't have any confidence in my ability to like stand up and walk over to the music and start it again. So I just like let the music stay off.
It might as well have been in China.
Right. And so
when you look down at your feet, they were hooves.
So I walk
on those.
This is gonna sound weird on the
clip clop, right. So the music stops, and for whatever reason, like once the music stopped, all of a sudden this just overwhelming, like the most intense sense of paranoia that you can imagine sets in. And I'm looking at the pool. I'm like sitting next to my pool, like the pool's right in front of me. And I'm just like conjuring up all these images of me and or my buddy falling into the pool and drowning.
Yeah, why were you there without a babysitter by the pool? Come on.
We just didn't have a babysitter that day. That's, you know, lesson learned. You got to have a babysitter. And so I'm looking at my pool, and now it's just like this.
What would the babysitter do in that case? Like, the babysitter doesn't know that you're looking at the pool and seeing.
No, but the babysitter.
Because your O face has turned into an O shit face.
No. No. Glenn, you're missing the obvious. The babysitter could have walked across the yard and turned the music back on for me.
Yeah, but you would have had to gather up all of that strength to just say, go to
It's not that bad. It's not that bad.
All right.
It's not like Stephen Hawking or anything really bad like that. But all of a sudden my pool becomes this insidious death trap, and I just start. There's no other way to say it. I just start freaking out. And I tell my buddy, I got to go inside. And I felt like I just really needed to lay down. And I don't know if my buddy heard me. He was in La La Land. And so I walk into my house, and I go and I lay down on the couch. And, like, the paranoia doesn't go away. Like, it stays there. And in fact, if anything, it only gets worse. And where I really started to freak out was, and I'm 99.9% sure that this was all in my head, but it seemed like my body was forgetting to breathe. Like whatever the automatic mechanism is in your body that makes you automatically breathe without thinking, that had somehow been shut off. And I felt like I had to consciously will myself to inhale and exhale every breath. And that scared the shit out of me, because I was like, what if I stop breathing? I'm going to die. I've researched like the physiological effects of mushrooms. That's what leads me to conclude that I'm like 99.9% sure that was all in my head, because everything I've read, like mushrooms cannot and do not have any effect that inhibits or messes with your respiration. So after the couch, what I did is I basically paced around downstairs frantically. I thought, okay, maybe if I kick up my metabolism, maybe I can burn off these mushrooms faster. And so I just like paced like in a loop in my downstairs for, I don't know, like an hour. And the crazy thing was, is while I'm pacing around, I am experiencing the getting sucked in and getting sucked out. And so I'm pacing around and I'm seeing these incredibly chaotic visuals. Like, imagine someone throws a bunch of different colored paints in a blender and then spins them up. Like, that's what I'm kind of seeing. And then that'll go on for who knows how long, 5, 10, 15 minutes. And all of a sudden I'll come to, like I'll come out of it and realize that I've been pacing around the whole time, but I can't remember the pacing. All I can remember is like the visual hallucinations, the images that I saw in my head. And then there was a point where I stopped pacing around and just like tried to regain my sanity. And I remember I had both my hands like gripping the island in my kitchen. And I felt like I was dissolving. You know, like Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future, where, yeah, the picture, how he's, yeah. I felt like I was fading from existence. And it was terrifying. Like, I seriously, literally, for real, for the first and only time in my life, thought I was dying. And the other thing that happens when you have a bad trip is you have this terrifying sense, the state of mind that you're experiencing, this like hellish, like tormented state of mind, is permanent. That it's going to last forever and you're never going to like be able to snap back to normal.
Like one of those dreams where you're walking, you desperately need to get to the end of the hallway, and the hallway, no matter how fast you walk, it's always going to be out of reach.
Yes.
Or the fourth level of Inception.
Yeah.
Hard to wake up from.
No, I literally like I thought I was dying, and I got so bad that I finally had to go out to my friend and say, "Hey, can you come inside and just talk to me? Because I think that'll help me." And we sat on the couch and I just kind of couch locked and just like sitting there, just like petrified, just terrified. And like every 5, 10, 15 minutes, I would just blurt out to my friend, is my wife okay? Are my kids okay? Am I okay? Like I just had this overwhelming sense of doom, like something tragic was afoot. I just kept asking him, is my wife okay? Are my kids okay? Am I okay? Is everything going to be okay? And he was reassuring and everything. And then after that went on for, I don't know, 45 minutes, maybe an hour, I just started bawling like a baby. I just started bawling like a baby and telling my buddy like every single thing that I like regretted in my life or felt remorseful for in my life. It was a very cathartic experience, but I just bawled like a baby. And oh, he already knew all my sins. And then what's odd about the whole experience was it was a lot more short-lived than the first one. The first experience was a really beautiful 5-hour trip. This ended up being more of like a 2.5-3 hour nightmarish experience.
You probably understand.
So like the third Hobbit.
I haven't seen those.
I stopped.
It's freaking terrible.
Especially at the end when they drop the Eagles drop them off like 100 miles from their destination. I think you got like a taste of what it's like to be a paranoid schizophrenic.
Dude, it was hell. It was hell.
And just imagine that's your permanent state of mind.
Yes. I say these things in the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
Jesus Christ, you say it in the name.
Say these things in the name of
Lumen Walters.
Vishnu. Vishnu.
You love anymore. This is Trent dwelling in the land of Mordor between two temples. You can comment on this episode on the website infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Did you stop recording?
No, I'm still recording now, but...
Okay, because I want to say, here's my one last line, okay?
Yeah.
I heard this the other day, and I think it's... I totally relate to it, and I think it's true, that going through life without ever having a psychedelic experience is like going through life without ever having a sexual experience. It's that big, it's that important, it's that life-changing, it's that... paradigm shifting.
I'm doing fine without either, so aww. I don't know if I'm going to buy that.
Well, you don't,
I don't believe it.
Ladies don't like that stuff anyway.
That's just for us guys.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.